Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library, as all of you know. My goal at the library is simply to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution levitate, and when successful, to make it dance. I would like to thank tonight's sponsor, Sutherland, Asbill, and Brennan. They are a proud sponsor of the New York Public Library and have been of Live from the New York Public Library for some years now. And they are also members of the New York Public Library Lawyers for the Library Committee. The firm was founded in 1924 and offers forward-thinking approaches and solutions to diverse clients in 7 major practice areas: corporate, energy and environmental, tax, financial services, real estate, litigation, and intellectual property. So thank you very much. Briefly, let me tell you about some of our other events coming up this season. Next week, I will be interviewing Umberto Eco. As part of the Rolex weekend afterwards, we will have Gilberto Gil, Jesse Norman, Brian Eno, Peter Sellers, Anish Kapoor, and many others. The following week, I can hear hum there, I like that. The following week, Diane Keaton, and just before Thanksgiving, Joan Didion. Followed right after Thanksgiving with Mary Beard, Josh Ritter, Wesley Stace, and Steve Earle. Join our email list and find out more and stay on top of what we're doing next season. The spring season will open with Tariq Ali and Oliver Stone in conversation. Tom Brokaw will happily sign books after our conversation, and once again, it is a pleasure to thank our independent bookseller, 192 Books. The first 10 people who sign up after our event tonight and become friends of the New York Public Library, obviously all of you are already friends of the New York Public Library, but support us even more, if you know what I mean, will get Tom Brokaw's new book out for free. Now, you all know who Tom Brokaw is, and for the last few years, I have asked the various guests I invite for a biography of themselves, written by themselves in 7 words, a haiku of sorts, if you really want to be modern, which maybe Tom Brokaw and I will talk about, a tweet of sorts. And so Tom Brokaw sent me the following 7 words, and they are 7. Some people, I ask for 7 words, they give me 27. No, there's 7 words. He knows what an assignment is. He said, curious, talkative, I'm grateful for that, impulsive, impatient, forgetful am I. Tom Brokaw.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words,
that was for you.
Oh, obviously. That was very nice, thank
you. You love Frank Sinatra.
Oh, I do, and I have and I had mixed experiences with Frank Sinatra. Obviously, of my generation, he was the voice. And he was larger than life in many ways. I encountered him along the way, and not always pleasantly, because I was a reporter, and he didn't like being in the news, and especially the way he got himself into the news. So he would do something inappropriate, and we would report it. And then the next day, his public relations person would come to see me. And he would say, you know, Frank doesn't think that you're aware that he's underwriting an orphanage in Mexico or some good deed thing. And I said, no, I did hear about that. It doesn't excuse the bar brawl in which he was involved last night or whatever. And then through an odd set of circumstances, one evening here in New York, we had a mutual friend, a kind of legendary figure by the name of Swifty Lazar, who was a great agent. And Swifty had invited Meredith and me to dinner, and it turns out he had also invited Frank's wife, and then Frank was going to arrive later. And oh my God, what is this going to be like? And Sinatra came, sat down, and looked at me, and he said, "Kid, I watch you every morning." I was doing the Today Show at the time. And he said, "I've got tickets for my concert if you want to come." He turned on the charm, and of course, I was instantly seduced by all of that.
Did you go to
because he could be this, you know, he didn't know which one was going to show up. But when the good one showed up, he was absolutely wonderful.
You went to the concert?
I didn't go to the concert, but I had another occasion later where, I don't want to get started on Frank Sinatra stories, but he made one of his greatest albums with Juan Carlos Jobim, and he made it at NBC because we had the best sound facilities. And the audio wizard who worked at NBC in Burbank in those days came to me because he knew I liked Sinatra and said, "Stick around tonight. It's going to be about 2 o'clock in the morning, but you'll want to hear this. Nelson Riddle and the orchestra, Juan Carlos Jobim." I went to the soundstage, stood way in the back where no one could see me, and Frank came in at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I saw the artist because he worked with the orchestra and the score, and he worked with Juan Carlos Jobim. He was just all business. The monofocus that he had and doing take after take after take. And I thought, that's why who he is, because he was so good at it.
It strikes me also in your story, and I promise you we won't only talk about Frank Sinatra, but it strikes me in your story that you also mentioned he was the voice. And if there's one thing you are known for tremendously, it is your own voice.
Yeah, it is, but it's widely imitated as well. Ed Hamilton says, "A drop dead imitate." No one does it better than David Gregory. Yeah. So I get picked up on a lot, and that's fine. It is a form of flattery. I can't sing a note. Meredith Brooke, I was
just
here tonight.
About to ask you,
brought music to our family, thank God, because the girls are fine. But I, you know, the paint comes off the wall if I open my mouth to sing, so I don't do it.
I'd like to begin quite simply by referencing the subtitle of your new book, The Time of Our Lives. The subtitle reads, "Who we are, where we've been, and where we need to go now to recapture the American dream." And when I read that subtitle, I was rather struck by just how loaded the terms are. And for a foreigner who has been in this country for 30 years, I would like you to explain to me what it means, these two words, American dream.
Well, everyone has their own interpretation, but I suppose if there is a kind of a consensus, it is the American dream is that our children will have better lives than we will. That every succeeding generation has a little better life in some fashion. It's gotten reduced to what I call the quantitative better life, and I think that's what we have to re-examine. How many houses, how many cars, how many jackets, how many toys can you have? And so that ought not to be the measure of the American dream. And what I try to do in this book is to turn the thinking some to the quality of life. Let's make that the measure of the American dream. More tolerance in America, more opportunity in the workplace, reforming our education system so everyone has an equal opportunity to move themselves forward, to do something about our political culture so it doesn't seem walled off from the ordinary Americans. I think that's getting at the American dream. And that is a question that comes up, as I say in the book, time and time again as I go across the country, from people on Main Street, people in power. They're worried about whether their children will have what they have. And so I ask them to examine, what does that mean? What do you mean, have what you have? Because happiness can be achieved in 1,000 different ways. And we ought to have a continuing pride in who we are as well. That should be a part of it.
And the word recapture is very important because it, in some way it bespeaks of something that was lost.
Well, I do think it has been lost to some degree. If you just look at the polling in this country now, the confidence in our institution is down. Institutions are down to single digits in many instances. Most people think that the country is very much on the wrong track, not on the right track. They express overtly their anxiety about the future that their children will have as they look at the workplace disappear. You know, I once did a series on NBC Nightly News about auto workers in America, and I picked five generations of them. I found the great-grandfather who had been worked in the original Ford factory, and he'd been beaten up by the goons when they tried to organize. His son caught the great wave of the 1950s, got big benefits, good salary, a good retirement program, had a house in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a big fishing boat, and a good life. His son was outsourced all across the Midwest, racing from Ohio to Indiana to these other outlying plants that were not part of the central Ford system. And when I said, what are you going to do about the 10-year-old? And they said in unison, the men said, computers. We've got to get him working on computers. So that's a transition. There was a time, if you had a strong back and a good pair of hands and good work boots, you could find a good job in America and get paid for it. We were the manufacturing capital of the world. That's no longer true. 40% of the American economy now are in financial services, shuffling money and creating new instruments.
But don't you think that worry of parents for the next generation, for their children to do better than they did in their own times when they were productive, is something that has always existed? Do you feel it is exacerbated in
some way? No, I think that even during the worst days of the 60s, I think that the greatest generation, as I called them, often would just shake their heads about how their kids were behaving, but they said, God, they're so smart. You know, they're so well-educated, and they travel so easily. And I can't believe the starting salary that they get at a law firm or at IBM or one of the places. I used to take the temperature of that generation a lot because I was covering the 60s a lot. And even though they were not happy with their deportment, they could see where they were the masters of the world. And the idea that their children could say to them, you know, Dad, I'm going to take a couple of years off, and I'm going to travel the world, then I'm going to come back and I'm going to start my career. Or they were starting businesses at a very early age, the boomers were, and doing inventive things. And their parents were looking at them with a sense of awe. Now their parents are looking at their children with a sense of anxiety. And by the way, they're looking at them across the dinner table because they're moving back in with them, the kids are, in big numbers. And they do it for a couple of reasons. One is economic. They can't get a job. They can't afford urban housing. The second is, as a number of them have said to me, I trust my parents. They're my best friends and the best counsel that I'm going to get. And I've seen what corporations have done to my dad or to my mother. I'm not going to go rushing into that.
Are parents doing a less good job, then, of educating their children?
Yes, but it's educating them for what? That's the issue. I mean, I believe that a society is always best served by a strong liberal arts undergirding. But in the modern economy, you also have to have specific skill sets to work in high-tech manufacturing. And therefore, there is a boom going on in America in community colleges because they're affordable and they're teaching young people practical skills to take to the workplace. And other young people look at their friends who go off to college and emerge, as 10% of them do now. Those with student loans, 10% of them have debt of $40,000 when they got out of college. That's a big load to start life with.
What you say reminds me so much of my own father. When I went off to university, just before I went off to university, both my parents are from an old Vienna. My father sat me down and said, you know, Paul, just don't forget that the word university comes from the word universe. Don't forget for one second that you might be going and studying literature and philosophy and law, as it were, back in those days, but right across the street is the medical school. Go and look how they cut up a body. Go and look at what other people do. And I was reminded by this, in part by this fabulous quotation you have of the former president of Yale, Jamati, where you say, yeah, it's fantastic. You are not expected to know, but you are expected to wish to know. I'd love you to elaborate on that, because I thought that was very inspiring.
I waited for Bart Giamatti's freshman incoming speech every year, and then his baccalaureate speech, and I poached him. And I made it clear to him, I'm ripping him off, Bart, as fast as I can. It was real alloyed wisdom of the best kind. And he gave these, you know, he was a very literary figure. He was a Renaissance scholar, and he would give wonderfully wise speeches to incoming freshmen and those who were leaving Yale. He would also say to them, as he did, I think that was a baccalaureate speech in which he said, do not become hostage to the orthodoxy of others as you leave here. And at that point, we were going through the Jerry Falwell, Pat Roberts influence in American politics, and the moral majority. And he found that tyrannical as a political ethos. And he was saying to the university, and he was threatened, by the way, for taking it on. But he was saying to the university students, you know, use your mind to reason, to think, to be independent. And we lost him far too early. We have, in my judgment, too few Bart Giamatti's in our life anymore. Too few. I also quote John Gardner, the founder of Common Cause, who had his own kind of populist wisdom about how we should conduct ourselves in a civil and a social society.
Do you feel that he was saying that because in some way young people are not adventurous enough when they go into school?
No, I think this is a pretty adventurous generation now. I don't think that they have the lodestars that they once did, because they find it in instrumentation these days. They find it on the screen. And how much they surf that to get that kind of wisdom, I don't know. But they're utterly fascinated, with good reason, by the new technology. I have a line that I use when I go to university campuses, in which I say, I never expected in my lifetime, certainly, something as transformative as this is for communication and research and commerce, and for ways that we can't even now anticipate. Online universities are exploding, for example. Bill Gates spends most of his evenings in online academies of one kind or another, reading great literature or learning new things. Then I say to them, but you're not going to reverse global warming by hitting backspace. You won't get rid of global poverty by hitting delete. And I end up by saying it will do us little good to wire the world if we short circuit our souls. You have to put your feet on the ground.
But you also say that you're worried of a day when someone will write a song called "A Tweet Is Just a Tweet."
As time goes by, right? I don't want to hear that song. And I also look into the audiences and say to the young people, no text message will ever replace a whispered "I love you" or holding hands on a first date. So what the
new technologies, while you see their value, what worries you about them is that people are not thinking enough about their limitations.
Well, because I think that humankind is advanced by technology that has wisdom in the hands that activate that technology, and has passion that they bring to their lives as well. It's an instrument. It's a tool. We have heads and hearts, and they should drive that technology, not the other way around. That's what I believe. I also worry that a Stanford law senior, when I was out there doing some work in Silicon Valley, I was sitting in the courtyard at Stanford Law School and was online, and this young man came over to me, and I'm very partial to Stanford because I left a lot of tuition there for my daughter when she went there for 4 years. But he said to me a very pertinent question. He said, Mr. Brokaw, you've written a lot about generations. What about my generation and the definition and the meaning of friend? Do we know what that means, and are we going to lose it because we've made it a verb? We're friending people now. Well, that's a very relevant question. How do you measure friendship? It ought not to be just because you share a Facebook page, or they know how to tweet you, or how to find you.
And also, one of the things that your book speaks about is the notion that technology in some way also interrupts our course of thinking. And I think this will lead us quite nicely into.
You really have to bring discipline to the technology. It's just way too easy to go on Google and just start surfing and searching for something, whether it has any meaning or not. Someone has said to me, and it's certainly true in my case, I have a friend who's not technologically advanced at all, and he's quite disabled, so he's confined to his library, and we were trying to encourage him to get an iPad. And he said, not meaning to be humorous, is that that thing that old men use when they wake up in the middle of the night so they can read the New York Times before the morning arrives? And I said, yes, that's it, actually. I know it well. We haven't had a dialogue in this country. It doesn't mean that we have to assemble somewhere to have that dialogue. But even within families, there's not been much of a dialogue. Best use of this technology, you know, what to be aware of. I'll segue into saying what I say to audiences as well about the impact of this technology on journalism, not just on the forms of journalism, but how we get our news. There was a time that a lot of you remember well, where you just got up in the morning and got the morning paper, or went to the newsstand and picked off one of the many papers that were available in New York, got home in the evening, watched Chet Huntley or David Brinkley or Walter, or a little later, I hope, Tom, Dan, or Peter. And maybe you caught the late evening news, and that was it. You were a couch potato. It was delivered to you. Now you have to be a proactive consumer. You have to go find the sources of this information, not just take it because it comes off the screen. And you have to measure the credibility and the reliability of it over time. I know somebody in Montana who comes to me quite wide-eyed on a regular basis and says, you're not going to believe what I saw on the internet today. And I say, you're right, I'm not going to believe it, actually, it turns out.
No, and yet there is a yearning. I mean, I see it in groups assembled such as this one. There's a yearning to come together. You, as I often say, you can't tickle yourself. You know, we need, in some form or fashion, we need others. Now, you say we must return to our fundamental obligation. It is time to re-enlist as citizens. And when you and I spoke, you repeated that term, re-enlist as citizens. What do you mean?
It's become my mantra for this time.
It seems like
And I just measure what we're up to against the history and the immediate legacy that we inherited. Here, let me give you an easy example of that. And I say this wherever I go, and a lot of you probably have heard me say it more than you'd like at this point. I have been engaged in the two longest wars in American history. That's an indisputable fact, Iraq and Afghanistan. And a lot of families in America have paid a terrible price in terms of loss of life or grievously wounded people physically and otherwise. They represent less than 1% of the American population. They're all volunteers. They come from middle-class and working-class families primarily. Very few elite institutions or upper-income families send someone off in uniform to fight for all of us. They're bearing this terrible burden. Nothing is asked of the rest of us. No additional taxes. We don't even have to think about it if we choose not to. We can go through our lives, and the war can be going out there almost as an abstract for us. That's not just unjust, in my opinion. It's kind of immoral in a democratic society. So that's an example of how I use how we then have to, the rest of us, have to, I have a title for a chapter called Uncle Sam Needs Us, and we have to re-enlist as citizens. This next year is going to be very important. I'm an umpire. I call balls and strikes here. I don't know whether the Republicans will win next fall or the Democrats or maybe even a third-party candidate. But I do know that it will be determined and defined by the people who get into the arena and pursue and encourage what they want for America to go forward. I said on Meet the Press a month ago and repeated it again recently that whatever you think about the Tea Party, and I can only guess in a room like this, but but the Tea Party played by the rules. They got angry, they got organized, they got to Washington, and they've stayed disciplined. And they have they're dominating the dialogue and the Republican presidential debates because of that discipline, out of proportion to their actual numbers. Because if you look at the polling, they don't represent a majority of Americans. It's in fact quite a distinct minority. But because they stay on message and because they use the instrumentation that's available to them, they're really the tail wagging the dog at this point in the Republican Party debate. So if you're not happy about that, if you want to counter it or bring your own passions to the arena, you got to reenlist as a citizen.
And in that same vein, you think that public service is so important now?
Yeah, this comes not just from me. This comes from the ground up. Again, wherever I go in the country, people say, why can't we have mandatory public service? Or a lot of males will say to me of a certain age, we should go back to the draft. The draft won't happen again. It's too politically toxic. The military doesn't want it. They like the motivated volunteers. But there's no reason why we can't elevate the idea of public service so that it's more than the sum of its parts. There are a lot of good programs out there now, Teach for America, AmeriCorps. But after being embedded with troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq, but especially in Afghanistan, on a couple of occasions, Special Forces in the 10th Mountain Division, I'd go into these remote clay villages where I'd see these guys that I was with in their goggles and Kevlar helmets and vests and Humvees, and they'd be shaking down the pickup trucks and confiscating weapons, and then in a way would say to the village elders, we're here to win your hearts and minds. It didn't work. It didn't connect. And I came away and thought, there's got to be a better way. We just can't have a military force in a face in America. And by the way, I so admire these young warriors because they're well-trained, and they know what they're doing, and they're frustrated because they're, too much is being asked of them. So I came back and thought, wrote about this in the Times, actually, why can't we have a diplomatic special forces, people who are adventurous and civilians? That led me to believe that we ought to have public service academies in America, 6 of them, attached to land-grant schools, make it public-private, have the Johnson & Johnson Fellow in medicine, the John Deere Fellow in agriculture, Caterpillar Fellow in construction. They spend 3 years getting the specialized training. Then they are assigned both by a combination of government and private sector coalitions to either work abroad or work in this country. At the end of 3 years of public service, then the corporation takes them in for 2 years to prove up, so to speak. They've got a chance to see whether they want to keep them and whether the young man or young woman wants to stay there. It's not as well formed as it ought to be because I was just really trying to kickstart a conversation. Originally, I said, I was trying this out in South Texas with some friends of mine, and big businessmen, and one of them, a very conservative guy. I didn't have the private piece of it at that point. He said, make it private public. Get the private sector involved.
And you're very interested in that partnership between public and private.
It's a growing trend in this country. You think it can work. Yeah, it's a big trend in this country. Mitch Daniels is doing a lot of it in Indiana, selling the toll roads and turning it over to private corporations. But on a smaller basis, across the country, water districts are being turned over to private companies, run more profitably and more efficiently. The state in which you live has 11,000 state agencies. This is a system that was designed for political patronage 100 years ago. This is not necessary for us to have that many state agencies here. Long Island, as you go across the counties, each county has a different water district and a different set of rules and well-paid commissioners.
What would you do if you...
I'd consolidate a lot of it. I would consolidate a lot of education in America. It's very tough because people have attachments. They have pride in these institutions. And the system that is going to consolidate and change and reform them is a system that is being rewarded by the way it exists now.
Right.
So they're not inclined to do it.
We had on this very stage Malcolm Gladwell with Wendy Kopp, so the founder of Teach for America. And one of the most powerful parts of your book is precisely your worry, really, with the state of education in this country. And you have this anecdote about being in Korea and seeing children congregating, very young children, I think, congregating.
Yeah, that was 15 years ago.
15 years ago.
I was there during the Olympics, and We're doing nightly news because of the time difference, very late at night, really early in the morning. And when I would finish, it would be not yet dawn. And I'd look down from the building where I was doing it. I was on a rooftop, and there was a junior high courtyard below me. And at about 5:45, 6 o'clock in the morning, flashlights would suddenly be all over the courtyard, and it would be students doing their homework, waiting for the doors to open at the junior high. That's how motivated they were. And the doors were not going to open for another hour or so. Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, talks about President Obama having a meeting with the President of Korea recently, and the President, our President, opened the conversation by saying, "So, what are your problems with education in Korea?" And the President of Korea said, "The parents are demanding more of me than I can satisfy them with right now." We've got the flip of that going on here. Here is Korea in 1950, was a Stone Age economy, 80% illiteracy. Now it's one of the great industrial powers in the world, and they did that in the most hostile possible conditions, that rocky little peninsula out there. And anyone knows of the Korean Americans who come here and open businesses and go to school, you know, how driven they are. I deliberately didn't choose China to make it the centerpiece because we all know about that, but it's going on everywhere else as well.
I very much enjoyed reading this encounter you had with President Obama, where he said the biggest lesson we learned from World War II is America can do anything when it puts its mind to it, but we got to exercise those muscles. I think they've atrophied a bit. We're soft in ways that we are profound, that are profoundly dangerous to our long-term prosperity and security. The notion of atrophied muscles, I'd like you to expand on that, and in some way, I think it does connect to your story.
I don't think he's wrong. We went to war after 9/11 on a credit card and didn't ask. On a credit card. We didn't ask anything of the rest of us, no sacrifices whatsoever. We were kind of encouraged to go back and go shopping again. We had this enormous boom in housing, which was irrational, so much of it from the beginning. I remember our daughter calling me from San Francisco when they were buying their first home. She said, "My God, Dad," she said, "they're offering these 20-year deals with interest only for the first 15 years, but you know, you could see what was going to come at the end of the first 15 years. And she said, we're going to be more cautious about it, but I worry about my friends. And I went to a couple of major construction people at that time, and I said, "What in the world is going on?" And they said, "There's so much instrumentation out there now that people will loan anything." And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were driving a lot of that, and that was those were two political institutions, quasi-public. And they got very clever, Jim Johnson and others, about getting the idea of home ownership for everyone when plainly not everyone was qualified and was going to be equipped. We're paying a big price for that now. We've got 20 million homes in this country at the moment that are either in foreclosure or stressed or in danger of going into foreclosure. That means you've got 20 million homes that are not buying new appliances, not buying new carpeting. They can't move to a new job. They're stuck. And they're stuck with the biggest investment they're going to make in their life for many of them. This represents a lot of their net worth. And until we get the housing thing figured out, it's going to be a harder job to get the economy really rolling back on track in a way that we need to. And neither party is talking about that, which is kind of striking to me.
Your book is made of some very poignant questions, and one of them is a question that John F. Kennedy asked many years ago. If John F. Kennedy were around today and asked you what you could do to your country, what you have done for your country recently, how would you answer? How would you answer?
I would say I appeared at the New York Public Library and brought
that's
in a
one,
lot of people.
Yeah, that's one of the things. What else would you
say?
Well,
I honestly think that I'm at a stage in my life. If there's an oxymoron in American life, it is a humble anchorman. We don't exist. So this is immodest of me, but I seem to have earned a certain place where people will listen to me, and I've always cared about the country. And the Greatest Generation, writing that book, gave me a kind of a platform that was completely unanticipated. So I thought I ought not to squander that. So I ought to step up as a, not just as a citizen and as a journalist, but as a father and a husband and a grandfather. And if I see these things, I ought to write about them and try to start this dialogue, which is what I'm trying to do with this book, about where we need to get to next. Now, in our family, we all do a lot of different things. Meredith is here tonight. She's got a microfinance project going in Malawi. I've got a daughter who's on the board of Habitat here, another daughter who spent a lot of time in Haiti this year, living in a tent with rodents crawling all over. She was down there doing grief counseling. Another daughter who worked for the International Rescue Committee is a ER physician in San Francisco. Because we were raised by parents and grandparents who just saw that as a part of the natural calling of life, that you gave back in some fashion. So I've done that, but I think I like to think that my larger contribution is to try to engage people in the events that define their time.
And you have passages in the book precisely about the legacy your parents left to you, and how careful and cautious they were, and thrifty, and never spent more than they had.
Right.
You say, like almost everyone else of their age, they were thrifty by nature and necessity. They didn't spend what they didn't have, and they saved something every week.
And sometimes to a fault. I mean,
they
were too thrifty. They didn't, you know, I would say, lighten up a little bit. You know, you can afford this. But it was hard for them to do it. They just, you know, it was hard for them to spend the extra buck sometime. Now, didn't mean they didn't have a great life. They did. They did everything that they wanted to do. And I had the good fortune of having real resources. And so I could help them in ways that, you know, on trips or helping them buy a retirement place. But it never defined our relationship. When my dad died, unfortunately, the week before I began Nightly News, of a massive coronary, but about 3 weeks before I began Nightly News, and it had been announced, and this was, you know, a great thing for our family, for me to suddenly have this wonderful job and all this responsibility, and it came with it a very substantial salary, and I caught the wave of people getting paid a lot of money for doing this kind of work. And it got a lot of publicity. And my father, who never earned, I think, cash income more than $9,000 a year in his life, maybe at the end he did better than that. He worked for the Corps of Engineers as a construction foreman. Anyhow, he called me, had a wonderful sense of humor, and he said, "So I'm reading these reports about your salary. Is that true?" And I said, "You know, Dad, we've never talked about my salary before." And I had made good money before that, but this had taken me to a different level. And I said, "Why do you want to?" "Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm just reading about it." I said, so we went on to something else. And about a week later, Time Magazine did a very detailed reporting of how much Dan was making, Peter was making, I was making, Barbara Walters was making. So my father was red-haired, very red-haired, and he called me, and I called him Red, and Red called me back. And he said, "So I'm reading Time Magazine." I said, "Come on, Dad, why are we talking about this?" He said, "I'll tell you why we're talking about it. For as long as your mother and I have known you, you've always run a little short at the end of the year. We need to know how much to set aside this year." So, it was a perfect, perfect way of dealing with it. I also tell a story in the book. I took him shopping in California one time. He came out to visit us in a very high-end place called Gelson's. Is that the name of the supermarket?
Right. Yeah.
And we were driving. I had the cart going through the supermarket, and I thought I would show off my thrifty gene. So they had fresh squeezed orange juice. And I said to Dad, "That stuff is really expensive. Let's get the box stuff." And he reached down into my shopping cart and picked up three very expensive bottles of California wine. And he said, "I guess the money that you saved in orange juice will help pay for these." And kind of put it in perspective for me.
But he must have been very proud.
He was proud, but he, you know, he was not immodest about it. And you could not ask my mother about me without her saying, "And my son Bill, who lives in Denver, is running a restaurant. My son Mike went to the Marines. He lives around the corner." They just didn't play favorites. And my father, when I first got to have some kind of public celebrity, somebody once asked him when he was at a gathering at the Elks Club. He went to the Elks Club in our hometown, and somebody said, are you related to Tom Brokaw? And my dad looked around and said, I think he's a cousin. I'm not sure. But,
another aspect of your book that I'd like us to talk about is, which I didn't really know, is the incredible importance you attach to what one might call an enlightened form of philanthropy. Philanthropy plays an important role, and by that I mean foundations such as one of the ones that I'm particularly attached to, too, in this city, is the Robin Hood Foundation. Right. And you talk about it as in a way, a model. The Robin Hood Foundation would do well to expand in many different cities.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have the Robin Hood Foundation. I was a big skeptic when it first started. These are a bunch of rich guys just trying to buy some reputation here. And I had a lot of friends who were involved in it. And they invited me to their breakfast, which they have every year. They've got another one coming up before too long. And John Kennedy Jr. was there at the time, and he introduced two young men that he'd gone to prep school with who were running a school up in East Harlem. And it was very moving about what they were doing in the school and how John was attached to them. So when John was lost, I thought, you know, what can I do? I went up to that school and said, I'd like to help out for a while here. And I did. And then the Robin Hood people came to me and said, we could really use you on the board because, you know, we're all hedge fund guys and we make a lot of money, but we don't have much of a political ear. We don't understand how the rest of the world works as much as we're used to having our way. We need somebody to give us a reality check. So I went on the board, and I must tell you, I was astonished at the commitment of these very busy people, and B, the discipline that they brought to how they gave away their money. They pay all the overhead for Robin Hood. They have metrics in which they go out to agencies, very professional staff, take the measure of an agency for, say, unwed mothers or for abused family members, and they'll say, they come back and say, you know, that one's not going to work. It's not very well. Or it's doing something really important, but we need to go in and help the staff. And they pay for everything. All that is done. Now, this is the most generous country in the world. There's no other country in the world that gives money as freely as the United States does for a variety of causes. And no city will ever compare with New York when it comes to raising money. I mean, I do a lot of events at the Waldorf. And for causes that almost no one knows about, and it, you know, it's now routine to raise $1.5-2 million on a night at the Waldorf. One of the things that when we first began to have some money in our family, and my girls sometimes were even more generous than I wanted them to be about how much we should give away and when. But I'd grown up with no money, and when I found part of the attractiveness of it is it does, A, give you freedom, and B, you can help out worthy causes. But Robin Hood is a model, but there are a lot of models.
There are lots of models.
I'll just share one other one with you that I'm particularly taken with now. And this has to do with education, which I think a lot of how we reform education in America will depend on the public-private partnership. There's a man in Atlanta by the name of Tom Cousins, who is a very, very successful commercial developer down there. He built a CNN center, and he owned the sports teams, and he rebuilt downtown Atlanta. He is probably a third or fourth generation Georgian, well-educated, a man of faith. He's a Presbyterian, married to a wonderful woman. And he was making a lot of money, and he was doing small things. He wanted to do something bigger, and he is a part of Atlanta called the East Lake area. And it had a golf course called the East Lake Golf Course. It was where Bobby Jones played his first and last round of golf, but it had completely deteriorated and it was surrounded by the most crime-ridden neighborhood in Atlanta. And Tom decided that he could change the neighborhood by beginning with the golf course. And everybody told him that was the dumbest idea they'd ever heard. And his response was, I've lost a lot of money on your dumb ideas. I'm going to lose some on my idea now. And he went and he reformed the golf course, and then he sold memberships in it, and he made a fair amount of money. He took all that money. He went to the community. It was not an easy sell because they were suspicious that it was just a white guy coming in to take advantage of them. And he said, you need mixed income housing here. I'm going to build it so we can bring black working class and middle class families in, and we need to change the school system. He did all of that. It is an amazing model environment. CNBC did a documentary on it, and Warren Buffett saw it, and so did Joanne Robertson, who is, a lot of you know, is one of the fathers of the hedge fund industry. They called him up and said, put us in, we're your partners. And they have something called purpose-built communities now. They're in Indiana, they're in New Orleans, they're in Charlotte, they're going to go into Omaha, into these downtrodden areas, and what they're doing is creating communities and making the school the centerpiece. And I don't know how much of his fortune he'll give away, but he couldn't be happier, and he couldn't be more modest about it. So I thought he deserved attention, and there are other examples like that. And that goes on in this country, and what we need to do is to elevate that kind of an example, it seems to me, and make sure that that becomes our goal.
And so that is where the interest in enlightened philanthropy resides.
It does, and one of the things that's happened in philanthropy is that this new generation, Tom is of my age, but the new generation, the Bill Gates of the world, there's never been anything like what Bill and Melinda are doing. The amount of money they're spending and where they're spending it in the world, how actively they're involved. This generation of philanthropists, they want to run their money. You know, we're surrounded by this library and the Vanderbilts and the Fricks and the J.P. Morgans, and they've made, and the Ford Foundation, but they really turned their money over to a foundation and walked away. This new generation wants control, and they're doing it and having a big impact in a lot of areas. Education, I think, will be helped in part by Eli Broad, the home builder from Los Angeles. Jim Simons, the math professor who made so much money as a hedge fund guy. You know, they've got math courses going, because they know what education did for them.
So I love that story you tell about Gates and Buffett and why.
Oh, shall I tell that story?
Yeah, tell that story because it's a wonderful story.
I got to know Bill early because I thought he was going to want to get in our business because we were going to have to do content at some point. So I made a point of, well before I fully understood what he was up to, I made a point of going out to Seattle and getting to know him. And in fact, MSNBC stands for Microsoft NBC. We formed a partnership, didn't work out perfectly, but we still have many pieces of it in place. But Bill would come back to New York and have meetings. And he was meeting with Jack Welch one day, and Jack called me because I'd helped bring Bill into the building. He said, come on up here, and we've got some stuff we have to discuss. And I went up, and then they took our picture. And this is before Melinda kind of got control of Bill's wardrobe and his personal grooming. You know, he didn't care about all that stuff. I mean, it looked like his hair had been cut by shrubbery shears of some kind. And he had a plaid jacket, I remember, and striped pants. And Jack is in his power CEO suit, and I'm in my Anchorman outfit. We have our picture taken. And they get the picture to us immediately, and I'm going off to lunch with a very close friend of mine, who is on Warren's board and also his lawyer, and he called and said, hey, Warren's going to be there as well. We all known each other for a while. And we go to lunch, and I show the picture to Warren and to my friend Ron, and I say, you're a mother. You have three sons. Which one are you worried about? And Warren, without missing a beat, said, yeah, I often tell people that Bill and I are so rich because we share a comb. And I thought, that was a killer line.
In your 50 years of being an
half a century, yeah.
But that also, I mean, there is that, but it's also the strengths of longevity in dedication in doing something fully. Who served you early on and later on as models?
Who did I model myself on?
I mean, there is
I had the in my profession.
Yeah,
I had the real privilege of being raised by newspaper guys. I caught the wave early. I got some very important jobs at an early stage in my life, and newspapers were still the dominant. culture when it came to covering politics and covering everything in those days. And when I was in Los Angeles, for example, I arrived in 1966 as a 26-year-old to cover Ronald Reagan running against Pat Brown for governor. And the LA Times had a really first-rate political reporting team, older guys. And I've often thought back, and I don't know what prompted them, but they kind of metaphorically put their arm around me and helped me through it and kept their eye on me. And we became friends. We'd have dinner every night. And one of them turned out was Paul Conrad, who was a brilliant Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist. And then I began to write a little bit for the Times, and that kind of sealed the deal, that, you know, they felt like I was one of them. When I moved to Washington as a White House correspondent, I was coming from L.A., where I was known primarily as a local political reporter, and there was some skepticism about whether I could do the job. And after about 3 weeks on the job at the White House, there was a legendary Washington newspaper man, who, by the name of Peter Lissagor from Chicago, was the best of breed. And he did the same thing. He kind of became my friend. And we stayed in very close touch and talked to each other. And then my really closest friend, a contemporary of mine, was a Wall Street Journal reporter. That really, I thought, that helped me a lot because it gave me this disciplined framework in which to operate as a broadcast journalist. But also the standards of print journalism were different than what we did in broadcast. And most of all, what it did was keep my ego in check. You couldn't be a diva around those guys. I mean, they would let the air out of me in a nanosecond if I kind of got puffed up. Peter Lissagor used to mouth when he'd see me across the way. I'd be up in the booth at a convention, for example, presiding over our coverage, kind of feeling pretty good about this. And I'd look down out of the booth, and 4,000 people, I'd absolutely find Peter, and he would mouth this obscenity to me silently, and it would break me up and kind of bring me back, you know, to what I was doing. That was very helpful to me. And older guys, even across, I mean, Walter Cronkite and I became friends, and I treasured that. And Andy Rooney's not doing well right now. He's having a hard time, and I just will cherish that friendship forever. He's just a great man. When I made him a member of the Greatest Generation and wrote about him, he would just argue with me. I don't think I'm a member of the Greatest Generation, Broca. I don't even like the phrase veteran. I don't think you ought to call us. I finally said, Andy, I'm going to put an asterisk by your name in the book and say everybody's a member of the Greatest Generation except Rooney here. So,
but you still hold on to that phrase.
I hold on to
the phrase "the Greatest Generation."
I do, and I my defense is very short. I say that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I leave it at that. I used it before the book was written on the air, and a lot of people responded to it, and I've had a lot of challenges to it, and I'm prepared for that. It was not a perfect generation. I don't say that, but in fact, that generation came out of the war, it came out of the Depression, where they were. Life was about deprivation and sacrifice and not about a lot of hope, never whining, never complaining, and then went off and fought the greatest war in the history of mankind. In 1939, this country was the 16th military power in the world. By 1941, we're in the greatest war of all time. And it's in the Pacific, as well as in Europe, it's in North Africa, it's on 6 of the 7 continents. And pacifists one day after Pearl Harbor have enlisted and become warriors. And at home, we stop all civilian production of automobiles and turn out new tanks and new weapons. They're building the B-29 down in Wichita. I talked to one of the machinists. He said the engineers would leave on a yellow legal pad drawings the night before, and we would machine them all night long. By just looking at the drawing, we could figure out these were farm boys who knew how to do this kind of thing. And they did nothing less than save the world. And it was not just the Americans, obviously. The Brits holding the line originally, and then the Russians pushing the Germans back, which was hugely critical. And then they came home and they didn't whine and they didn't whimper again. You know, they went to college in record numbers, they built new industries, they gave us new art, new science, built states like Florida and Texas and California, got married in record numbers, went to college, and then set about in the 1950s to achieve a prosperity none of them ever believed that they could have. And they resisted some of the changes, But in fact, as I remind people, Betty Friedan was a member of the Greatest Generation. She began to change the attitude about women in America. And the African-Americans who served came back, and that became the foundation for the Civil Rights Movement, because they were not going to be discriminated against in the same way. And then the next generation, led by Dr. King and others, really did change that. The Greatest Generation members of it did launch the war in Vietnam, but members of the Greatest Generation were our most articulate critics of it as well in the well of the Senate, George McGovern and Gaylord Nelson and the others who gave another kind of voice to it. So I'm satisfied that there was a generation worth celebrating. That's how I would put it.
Take us back a little bit when you began and you were an anchor so many years back then. Was it easier back then, do you think, than it is now?
Oh, in my business?
Yeah.
Much easier, yeah. When I started in television news, I didn't see television until I was 15. We lived in such remote parts of the country. And then it was nirvana.
You saw it for the first time when you were 15?
I was 15. I saw the beginning of Huntley Brinkley Report in 1955. And I was just mesmerized by it.
Can you remember exactly?
Oh, I do remember the night it was coming on. I remember him talking about it.
What was your first impression?
I don't remember. I just remember the idea that we were seeing things that I never expected to see in my living room in South Dakota. You know, that I read the papers, I saw movie tone news, but then to have on the black and white Zenith television set at 5:30 at night, two guys doing a 15-minute broadcast and seeing, you know, what was going on in Washington that day, and stuff that was going on in Europe, it was amazing. Before that, to go see the World Series in the small towns in which I lived, a mother would put all of us in the car and drive to Sioux City, Iowa, and we would stand outside a department store and watch on television to see the World Series or go to Sioux Falls because they could get signals. We couldn't get them in our remote area. When I got to the big town of Yankton, population 9,000, we had a television signal. I had three channels to choose from. And on Sundays, I remember watching Walter Cronkite, you know, doing his Sunday afternoon kinds of shows. Ed Murrow was a huge hero of mine, watching all that. And I suppose then that the thought began to form, gee, I'd like to do that. The thing about television, network television in those days, it was a real meritocracy. They reached out across the country to get the correspondent corps. And Time Magazine and the New York Times and the other great print institutions, he had to come from Harvard or Yale or, you know, have a different pedigree. In television, it was an open field. I often describe it as the Oklahoma land rush, a lot of us rushing across that landscape. So I started in Omaha, and when I was there, the station had a very good reputation, and we would often feed stories in to Huntley Brinkley. And I remember one of the officers of NBC came out. They were going to go from 15 minutes to a half an hour. They were worried they weren't going to be able to fill the half hour. So they were asking the affiliates, you know, to keep your eye on stories. And the first time I appeared on Huntley Brinkley, one of the flying Walendas fell off a sway bar at the circus in Omaha and died. And one of the photographers got a picture. And I was on the air with it.
With so many networks now available and so many different ways of getting information,
right,
is network news still relevant?
Well, I think now, I walked into Bloomberg last night, and I was doing Charlie Rose, and I like going over there. And Bloomberg's got, you know, a big stage, as it were, with the radio and the internet and television and a lot of stuff going on. And I said, if I were starting over, I'd probably be looking at something like Bloomberg, you know, to go to work for. Doesn't mean I'd give up on NBC, because we've got a lot of platforms as well. But all my friends, my contemporaries, when I started in this business, thought I was crazy, because they were all going to law school. They were going to work. I was of the generation where you'd go get a job for IBM, and you'd be a lifer. You'd stay there forever. I was a little more adventurous. I thought maybe I could get the network to pay for me to see the world. I now realize I overwished on that count. I've seen more of it than I needed to. But it was very exciting, the idea that you could, you know, get on a plane and fly somewhere and be on the air. I went from Omaha to Atlanta right at the height of the Civil Rights Movement, and that's when NBC picked me up and sent me to California.
But by the time news comes to anchors, it is old news now. It's already been on the Huffington Post. It's already been in so many different places. So
yeah, it changed. The technology changed. Dan, Peter, and I had grown up as correspondents. We wanted to be reporters. Now we find ourselves in the anchor chairs. But fortuitously for all of us, technology changed, so the satellite made it possible for us to anchor from anywhere in the world. You know, we got on airplanes and flew to the Philippines when Cory Aquino was taking on Marcos, for example. It was a long way to go, but it was a very exciting story. And we were in China. We're the 1989.
You found yourself by chance in Berlin.
Yeah, and I was in Berlin by, well, not entirely by chance. I didn't think the wall was going to come down, but I thought it was a very good story.
And it wasn't a bad story.
I won the lottery. I was there, the only one who was there that night. And I was laughing about it the other day because I like the outdoors, and I don't have a really formal wardrobe, so I tend to wear like Patagonia and L.L. Bean jackets when I go on the road. And I had this kind of worn-out Patagonia jacket, and I was going on there the night the wall was coming down, and I thought, this is going to be around for a long time, this videotape. So I went over and got Mike Betcher, one of our correspondents, had a really good-looking top coat, and I traded jackets with him. And So I show up in this very handsome top coat, you know.
Bring me, because I watched that moment of you at the Berlin Wall. Bring us back to what it was like to there were a few milestones, at least three, that are tremendous. Watergate, the Berlin Wall, and reporting 9/11. And I think the last one, of course, I think probably must be one of the most difficult moments to report.
Well,
and if you can bring us back to what it felt like to report those three stories.
I'll put it quickly in a larger perspective. I think nine people say to me, was that the biggest story you ever reported? I said, it was the most difficult day and the most difficult days that came after that. I do think the biggest story of our lifetime is the fall of the Soviet Union and the redefinition of communism with the rise of China, the fall of the Soviet Union, the liberation of Eastern Europe. And that's still playing out. That was an enormous seismic event in history. And it lowered the threshold of the chances of thermonuclear exchange between these two superpowers. We still have the other area. So when I got to Berlin the day before the wall came down, because there was not much going on here, and they were trying to get out of Berlin and get to Czechoslovakia and other places, and we're racing around. We had more access than we'd ever had before. I could go through Checkpoint Charlie and report on the other side. And then late in the afternoon, on that Thursday, the propaganda chief for the East was at a news conference, and it was a typical communist bureaucratic news conference. He was fending off all these questions. I was exhausted because I had been up most of the time since I'd left on Tuesday at noon. And then all of a sudden someone handed him a piece of paper. And he said, his name was Schabowski, he read the paper and he said, the Politburo has decided that residents of the GDR can exit and return through any of the gates in the wall, or words to that effect. And it was like hearing this beam come in from Mars. And the people in the room couldn't believe what they were hearing. And then the man folded his fingers, thank you very much, and he left the stage. I had an appointment with him, it turns out, to interview him right after the news conference. So I went upstairs and got the camera in place, and I said, Gunter Schabowski, just pull that piece of paper out again and read it to me again, and let's talk about what it means. He pulled it out, and he read it again. And I said, that means that residents of your country, citizens of the GDR, can leave anytime they want to, through the wall. He said, yes, that's what it means. And I ran downstairs, and some of my print colleagues were standing there, Roy Gutman from the Long Island newspapers, and they were trying to figure out, can this mean it? I said, the wall is down. It's going to happen. So we raced back through the wall, through the gate, at Checkpoint Charlie. The guard who had given us a terrible time going in and out for the last 2 days was standing there, and he kind of let us breeze through. And I stopped, and I said, do you know what's happened? He'd been watching television. He said, yes. And I said, what do you think? And he said through the interpreter, I'm not paid to think. And he went on his way. That night, by the time I got to Brandenburg Gate, the people had come from the West, and they were cheering on the young people on the other side of the wall who were very uncertain about whether they should get up and come over the wall or not. one of my cameramen had been down at another gate, and he came and he had the first footage of people coming through the wall, and then they poured over the top of the Brandenburg Gate. It was the most exciting single event to know that I was the only one there. You know, everybody else was back in studios in New York covering it, and I kept thinking to myself, don't screw this up, Tom. Just don't screw this up. This is a big deal.
Do you care to say something about Watergate and reporting at that moment?
What it would be like today?
Yeah. No, Watergate.
Watergate.
Yeah.
Watergate was, it would be much different today, unfortunately. People would be making judgments 24/7 about guilt or innocence. And the White House press corps, I look back on that as a model of tempered reporting. We reported what we knew. We had suspicions, and things kept unraveling as we went along. But no one went on the air and said, he's guilty, and there's no way around it. Or we didn't have a lot of people debating each other on the air. Moreover, as a practical matter, as a reporter, when I finished with the evening news at 7 o'clock at night from the lawn, I could go work the phones to get ready for the Today Show the next morning. I didn't have to go on MSNBC and talk to Chris Riley or Rachel or somebody there and speculate. I was going to do the work of a reporter. So when I got on the Today Show the next morning, I had new sources and new information and new ideas. It was a real constitutional crisis. The presidency was at stake, the country was deeply divided. But what I always remember about it, I was in San Clemente when the Supreme Court decision came down that they would have to give up the tapes, and everybody knew it was over at that point. And what I remember about it was once the tapes came out, this country, even the last defenders of Richard Nixon, said he broke the law, he's got to go. They either said it to themselves or it was an unspoken, but everyone knew. I had been courting some Republican senators during most of that year who were, you know, defenders of the president. They were conservative Republicans. And one of them called me at about 6 o'clock the night that the tapes came out. And he said, Tom, you've been very patient with me. He said, it's over. And we're coming to tell him that. We're going to make a call first. And the White House told them not to come, that the president's made a decision that he's going to resign. That was a very dramatic time. Tanks didn't roll in the streets, and there was no military coup of any kind. People didn't hang on at the White House. I remember about 2 days later, after President Ford had been sworn in, one of the White House staffers, who'd been very loyal to Nixon, came down the hallway to get something and then burst into tears. And I said, Ruth, what's wrong? She said, they told me to go get the president's papers, and I don't know which president they're talking about, President Ford or President Nixon. So, but we got through that transition.
In closing, I'm wondering two things. First of all, when you look back, any regrets, any stories that you feel you could have told better, any stories that you feel you withheld and wished you had told?
Yeah, I didn't go to Vietnam, and I regret that. I was a young reporter for NBC, and they didn't send married reporters. They sent mostly single people. I covered the war at home, as I often described it, and that was a big piece of what was going on. But I wasn't there, so I regret that. Most people say it's nothing to regret, given all the other things that I've done in my life. Stories that we could have told better.
Jesus. Told differently, told better, that you feel you didn't tell?
I think that the signs were there for this economic downturn. I don't think we did a very good job. I was kind of out of the chair by then, but I wasn't. I went back and looked at, I write about this in the book, on the night of the millennial change from the New Year's Eve, 1999. None of us was saying that this was likely to happen.
We're very near to the library.
Louis Uchitel in the New York Times, a man I don't know, wrote a very prescient piece about how overheated the market was and what could happen. But the rest of the world, we were worried about Y2K. We didn't see 9/11 coming. The spring before the attacks of 9/11, I had gone down to see the director of the FBI, Louis Free, because I was working on computer hate, a story about these racists and bigots who were using, and it was very well organized, computers to spread hate. And some people had been murdered as a result of their actions. And I wanted the FBI to cooperate with us on a documentary about how they solved hate crimes on the computer. And Louis said, that's not high on our list of priorities. That will work its way out. You guys ought to be looking at terrorism. I'll never forget that. That was in like March before the 9/11 attacks. And I walked out with my colleague and friend Andy Lack, who was the president of NBC News, and we kind of talked about that, and he said, maybe we should look into that, but it kind of faded away. And then 9/11 happened.
How do these things fade away?
Well, it faded away because, and I think this is part of what's going on now, it wasn't tangible in a way. Even though we'd had the attacks on Khobar Towers and the coal and Tanzania and Kenya, you know, we all were lulled into thinking they won't come here. I think part of the problem at the moment in this country is you can't touch and feel and smell or feel the hot winds of the debt that we're in this country. So people can put it out of their minds. It's not looming over them in a way. You can talk all you want about what it's going to cost your children and grandchildren, but because it's not tangible, it's more of an abstract, I don't think it has the same impact.
In closing, you write about the state of journalism today, and you say this about investigative journalism. You say, without investigative journalism, what would we know about the People's Revolt in Egypt, or long before that of Watergate? The Silent Spring, AIDS, Iran-Contra, Tiananmen Square, war, Islamic rage, nuclear proliferation, peace, calamity, and heroism. Tomorrow I'm welcoming on this very stage Errol Morris, who in a speech he gave at Berkeley, a commencement speech, since you like commencement speeches, he says this: I have often wondered why we need the phrase investigative journalism. Isn't all journalism supposed to be investigative? Isn't journalism without an investigative element little more than gossip? And isn't there enough gossip around already?
I don't disagree with him. I've often said the same thing about investigative journalism. It's redundant in my judgment. But there are other forms of journalism. There's entertainment journalism. And I tell my friends in the print business when they complain about what they see on television, I say, okay, I want you to go to press tomorrow and onto the streets with only the front page. No sports news, no crossword puzzle, no cartoons, no entertainment guides. Just the front page, just to eat your spinach, folks, and we'll see how successful you are. So journalism is a broad spectrum. I do believe that the culture of journalism will survive all these changes.
You do.
And how it's delivered. Yes, absolutely. People will have a constant appetite for information about what's going on in their lives. Walter Isaacson has written this wonderful book about Steve Jobs, and I were talking yesterday about the publishing business, and he said something I hadn't thought about. He said, I am buying print copies of books because I know they'll survive, and I want my children and grandchildren to see them in print form. I don't know what happens to the electronic books that I am buying. Will I be able to retrieve those? Will I pay attention in the archival way of those books? So I think that's worth saying. What? Errol Morris, by the way, is, I talk about him in this book in the context of Robert McNamara. He's a brilliant documentarian. I thought Fog of War is a national treasure, quite honestly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, but I think they're going to be, after 90 minutes, they're going to be impatient.
A couple of good questions. Can we bring up a mic?
Or if you have answers. No questions? I think we've been at this for 90 minutes, so you probably have heard everything you need to hear from me. Go ahead.
Here, go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Brokaw. Thank you so much. for being here and for sharing your words. I was very inspired. I was particularly interested in your description of the collaborative environment in which you were raised professionally, the mentors, and as someone here who is not experiencing the same kind of cultivation in the workplace, more of a competition both among entry-level workers and among the more senior workers and entry-level workers. I'm wondering if you could speak a bit to your opinion on that. How did we move away from a cooperative workplace to a competitive workplace, and what effect does that have on the workplace and the productivity of all of us?
You want to repeat that question?
Can you make it shorter?
Sure.
Cooperative workplace versus competitive workplace.
Right, and specifically your inspiring mentors, and where did they go in the workplace today? Are they still there? Am I just not finding them? Are you here?
I'm not sure that I can answer that. I think they are still here. I think that it still exists. What I think is that the information overload and what we see on the screen all day, every day, has so many parts to it, it's hard to pull stuff out. So I don't think that we make the same kind of assessment or inventory that we once did. Life was a lot easier at one point in terms of choices that we had to make, and we knew what they were going to be. I think that that's not so true anymore.
Thank you.
If you could make your questions very tight.
Yeah. Very, very terse, very tight. Paul, it's good to see you.
Tom, good to see you.
I'm Bill McGowan. I'm a print journalist, and I've spent some years both attending and covering conclaves of print journalists, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, the Newspaper Association of America. And they bend themselves into pretzels every year talking about how they have to find new ways to reach young people. And at a certain point, there's a limit. Can you recommend a way for the news industry to get together with the educational system to somehow revive the gene for public affairs that seems to have somehow slipped out of the bloodstream of our society?
Yeah, that was a big internal debate in journalism about whether or not we should be trying to proactively encourage people to get in.
Because the newspaper industry and the news industry can only do so much.
Yeah. I honestly didn't think that was the mission of newspapering. It was to try to be a proactive agent for getting people interested in public affairs. I think our job is cover the news and raise hell. That's what I really think. And I think that other institutions have to then get involved in getting people more involved in public affairs. What I do think is that if you're reasonably nimble on the internet now, you can find almost any kind of organization that you want, including those that will pull you in to public policy discussions and make you part of a kind of cyber group. Part of the dilemma at the moment is that it's like drinking from a fire hydrant. There are just so many choices out there. And Bill Clinton talks about the need to have a place where you can kind of get a test for reliable information. He says society is atomized now by all of this information that is going on. So, I think we just have to continue doing what we're doing and make sure that public discourse is engaging, and that people understand that it has relevance to their lives.
We're going to take one more question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You just answered my question.
Okay.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. What's your advice for a young journalist looking for an inspiring story?
No. My advice for young journalists is study medicine. Think about becoming a doctor. My honest advice is this, is that obviously you have to get used to the new instrumentation, and I mean, you have to be a master at it because it's a lot of it's moving that direction. There will always be a place for someone who can write, someone who can express themselves coherently and explain complex issues in ways that people can take away something that is meaningful and useful to them, whether it comes off the internet or the printed page or even on television. We have far too much now of what I call the school of hand journalism. You've got everybody talking with their hands all the time. And it's kind of improvisational. The well-constructed sentence is as important over the air as it is on the printed page or on the internet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.